Good evening. Welcome, everyone. My name is Aviva Richman. I'm a Rosh Yeshiva at Hadar and really excited to be here this evening with all of you in the room in Manhattan and online. I'm glad that we could all be together tonight. I want to thank Hadar for creating a space to tackle Torah that feels both very important and also very difficult. Our discussion of sexual ethics and Torah this evening will surface difficult questions and sources, and please feel free to take a break at any point if you need to. I also hope it will be nourishing. Hard problems don't go away if we don't talk about them. And when we come together in community to think harder and to be braver, that can be a source of strength and growth. So thank you all for showing up tonight and being here. I've been working on the topic of sexual ethics and Talmud, especially questions of sexual consent and coercion, for over a decade and a half. And much of this exploration centers on tracing the meaning of the concepts of consent and coercion, ratzon and ones, in the Talmud and throughout the rabbinic tradition. People sometimes wonder what, if anything, is fruitful or generative in this work. How could Talmud possibly be helpful in addressing very real concerns of our contemporary and consciously feminist moment? So tonight, I want to share why and how I find this pathway so valuable. It's not because our Torah says the perfect right thing. It does not. But actually, nobody says the perfect right thing in this realm. And I find this meeting point of sexual ethics and Talmud generative because our sacred engagement with our sacred imperfect tradition, with our eyes wide open to the real world, can hold us in a journey through disappointment, honesty, and growth. So here's our roadmap for tonight. First, we're going to paint a picture of a vision of intimacy that is deeply embedded in consent and mutual respect. For this vision to be strong, it has to start with theology. It has to start with our relationship with God. So we will lay the groundwork for theology and interpersonal ethics of consent and mutual dignity. Then we will take a sharp swerve from dream to reality and turn our attention to when things go wrong. Not if things go wrong, but when things go wrong. This vision is shattered all the time. How might Torah be part of our resolve to confront realities of sexual violation? This is a very complex problem because it is not only about confronting real situations of sexual violation, but also about confronting failures in responses to real situations of sexual violation. There are bad actors who commit sexual violation, and then our leaders can disappoint us in how they respond, and Torah itself can disappoint us in its language and messages. So then finally, we will make another swerve as we insist on the potential for growth in people and in Torah. Instead of expecting Torah to offer ideal or perfect guidance from the outset, we will turn to Torah being right there with us when things go wrong and to move us towards adopting a posture of listening and learning. We will embark on this part of our journey as we witness the testimony of a particular woman in the Talmud who speaks up, a rabbi who listens, and how this simple but profound moment has lasting impact. Okay, so here's the vision. Radical ratzon, a theology and interpersonal ethics of consent and mutual dignity. We often think of relationship with God in hierarchical terms. God is powerful, we are not. Our task is to obey God's will, Indeed, one common religious trope is orienting ourselves to Ratzon Hashem, God's will. Often, doing God's will has a corollary, negating our own will. To the extent that the relationship between God and the Jewish people is often described in intimate terms, for example, husband and wife, this is hardly a setup for an ethics of intimacy rooted in mutual consent. Only one will seems to matter, God's will. Recent philosophers, especially post-Holocaust thinkers, including Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, a senior scholar in residence at Hadar, speak of a different picture where we have more agency in our relationship with God, a human-divine partnership. And picking up on this thread, let's look more closely at how the concept of ratzon, will, or consent, features in our relationship with God in early rabbinic sources to move beyond a picture where only God's will matters. So you can turn to the source sheet or follow the screen share. We're on source one. The word ratzon appears in connection to sacrifices, korbanot, throughout the book of Vayikra. Sacrifices may seem archaic and totally irrelevant to a discussion of intimacy, but actually, as Dr. Aviva Zornberg lays out in her beautiful commentary on the book of Vayikra, we should think of sacrifices and the sanctuary where they were offered as a site for our deepest intimacy with the divine. So it should matter to us what ratzon means in this context, in the plain meaning, when the Torah says, offer a sacrifice for your ratzon, lirtzonchem tizbachu, it seems to mean that as subservience to God, our sacrifices grant us favor by pleasing God's will, right? That unidirectional, what matters is us pleasing God's will. Yet, Midrash boldly asserts a new dimension to ratzon, which is that sacrifices require our consent. You can see this in source 2. Lirtzonchem, for your ratzon, we do not force the community to bring the offering against their will. We cannot be forced into this act of intimacy with the divine. One midrash, first brought to my attention by my student and now colleague Rabbi Akiva Mattinson, makes sure to name the importance of both God's will and our will in our relationship with God as inscribed by sacrifices. This is source 3. God doesn't need the animals. God doesn't need to eat meat or drink wine. The only thing that sacrifices do is reflect a meeting point between God's will and our will in this intimate relationship. You can see in the text, an offering of pleasing aroma before God. It is pleasing before me, says God, when I speak and my will is done. But then if you jump to the end of the text, why did I ask you to offer to me? In order to do your will. God's will and our will matters. Being in relationship with God does not mean I subsume my will to do God's will. It is about a mutual investment to manifest each other's will. There is a redemptive power to this kind of intimacy rooted in mutual ratzon, mutual will. Feminist writer and activist Audre Lorde's writings on desire offer insight that can translate into the meaning of intimacy in both the human and divine planes. In a formative essay, 1978, Lorde reimagines what the erotic means. Instead of a force for objectification of the body and transactional pleasure, the erotic represents tapping into our deepest desires and sense of self. This is source 4. She says, as we begin to recognize our deepest feelings, we begin to give up of necessity being satisfied with suffering and self-negation and with the numbness, which so often seems like their only alternative in our society. Our acts against oppression become integral with self, motivated and empowered from within. So when we cultivate an awareness of our deepest desire, our ratzon, we can access a sense of self, dignity, and responsibility. We become aware of our raw creative power, and this can motivate us towards action. We know what matters most to us when we are in tune with our ratzon. And from this sense of purpose and drive, we feel nourished to do the hard work it takes to actualize our will, what we want most in ourselves and in our world. So if we apply this teaching to how we understand an intimate relationship with God, the point of a religious life is not to negate ourselves to God's will, but to cultivate our desire, our true ratzon, our capacity for expression and action. Being in relationship with God allows us to be attentive to God's will and actualize ourselves simultaneously. That's our picture of mutual ratzon. This robust picture of mutual consent in our relationship with God can deeply inform what we are striving for in a Torah of interpersonal intimacy. While people often construe traditional marriage, traditional Jewish marriage, as an unequal hierarchical relationship, we should take note that the very first page of Tractate Kiddushin nonetheless stresses the importance of a woman's consent. Source 5. It says on the first Mishnah, a woman is acquired in three ways, famous Mishnah. Had the Mishnah taught a man acquires, I would have thought even against her will. Rather, it teaches the first word is Haisha, the woman is acquired. With her consent, yes. Without her consent, no. So consent, mutual consent, is actually inscribed in the very beginning of the tractate that deals with interpersonal intimacy in marriage. There is a lot of work to do in actualizing an interpersonal ethics of mutual consent, investment in each other's will, investment in each other's self-expression. And that vision must be our North Star. But now we're going to take our first swerve. Part 2, when things go wrong. When it comes to sexual ethics, we cannot assume we or others will always get it right. People get it wrong. Our communities, our leaders, even our most sacred texts disappoint us. So we'll now take a difficult swerve from this beautiful vision of radical ratzon, mutual consent, mutual investment in each other's will that I painted in part 1, and turn to a challenging moment in the Talmud, which sadly has resonant overtones to the present day. This is source 6, passage from the Yerushalmi. A woman approaches a rabbi and says, I was raped. Ne'enasti. He says, but are you sure you didn't enjoy it in the end? Amar la vela arev lach basof. This is one of the most devastating interactions one can imagine. A woman trusts a religious authority enough to disclose a traumatic sexual event. The response undermines her narrative. The story does not end here, but this two-sentence beginning begs so many questions and responses. What was the woman's motivation for disclosing this information to the rabbi? Did she need support? What actually happened to her? Was it traumatic for her? Was she hurt? Did this happen long ago or just recently? Was she young or old? Was she single or married? Did she want redress for the perpetrator? Who raped her? Was it someone from the community or an outsider, someone from her family? Did she have a question about a legal ruling? And if so, what was her question? To be able to stay married to her husband? To be eligible to marry a Kohen? Or did she just want someone to listen as she shared something so sensitive and personal? Like so many cases of rape, we will never know the answers to these questions for this particular woman. It is the norm for experience of rape to be shrouded in mystery. What stands out in this case is that a leader of the community finds out from the victim that the rape occurred, a rare piece of knowledge that then makes us aware of all that we don't know. and will never know about this occurrence. Most often, even the fact that a rape occurred remains a secret. Now let's turn to the rabbi's response. The opening exchange feels like a flagrant example of what we might call blame the victim, one of the persistent rape myths modern feminists call out, that women actually somehow enjoy coerced sex. A woman says that she was the victim of an act of violence, and the response is that maybe she wasn't a victim at all, but participated with pleasure. Supposing this was an illicit sexual offense, for example, adultery, the question about her enjoyment that the rabbi asks isn't merely probing for her bodily response. It also would suggest that she is guilty of a sin. So this is not only about when things go wrong, because rape happens, sadly. It is also about when things go wrong because rape is misunderstood, and misunderstood by people in positions of leadership and power. If the story in the Talmud ended here, I don't think I would have strength to continue learning Talmud. It would be too tragic, too complicit in a systematic legal manifestation of violence against women, even beyond the initial physical act of sexual violence. The story does not end here. But before we see how it continues, we'll first look at a parallel passage that amplifies what is going wrong in this interaction between the woman and the rabbi. As hard as this step is to bring our attention to when things go wrong, it is so important and actually sacred work to devote our attention to fully understand what is going wrong when things go wrong. So we're at source 7. This is in the Babylonian Talmud. A very early sage, Avua de Shmuel, has an instinct of suspicion around every case of rape. According to rabbinic law, if a woman committed adultery, she may not stay married to her husband. But according to many sources, if it was a case of rape, she actually may stay married to her husband. Avua de Shmuel raises a concern. How do we know that any case of rape was actually rape? What if she actually, in the end, consented or desired this sex act? So you can read this inside. Avua de Shmuel said, a woman who was raped is forbidden to her husband. We are concerned that perhaps it began as coercion, but ended as volitional. You can see how this is related to the question we saw the rabbi ask in the previous passage, but maybe you enjoyed it in the end. This view of Avua de Shmuel, that no case of rape can really be treated as rape, is extreme, and the Talmud has a hard time understanding it. The Torah itself proclaims a woman's innocence in a case of rape. And in order to square Avua de Shmuel's perspective, the Talmud has to come up with an extremely disturbing definition of rape that requires witnesses to continuous screaming so that the coercion is, quote unquote, observable in the eyes of the law. You can see this text continues in source 7. For Avua de Shmuel, what is the case of rape where the Torah is permissive? In a case where there are witnesses that she screamed from beginning to end. Given what we know about the likelihood of not having the capacity to scream at all, let alone throughout such a trauma, and the bodily response to try instinctively to minimize the trauma in rape, this approach of Avua de Shmuel practically makes the reality of rape disappear legally. What's going to meet this definition? It's devastating. So where do we go from here? I've brought you passages in the Talmud about realities of bad actors, disappointing rabbinic responses, and legal rulings that seem to almost enact violence by erasing rape. Are we at a dead end? I have found myself extremely moved by some of the recent writings of the legal philosopher Martha Nussbaum, especially her 2021 book, Citadels of Pride: Sexual Abuse, Accountability, and reconciliation. So turn to source 8. She says, how could society be different? Narcissism has to be undone early. Dante, she's dealing a lot with Western, the sort of Western classical tradition. Dante would say that Eros must be turned outward toward other people by an education that focuses on their separateness and their real value, and on the value of their own feelings and choices. It would involve continual practice in listening and seeing. It would then involve becoming capable of supporting another person's autonomous choice and imagining another person's subjectivity. With her words in mind, now let's return to the continuation of our initial story, which you have in Source 9. Remember, I said it didn't end with the rabbi's question, was it not pleasurable for you in the end? The interaction continues. So this is in the bold part in Source 9. The woman responds, defending her view in a strikingly rabbinic style of discourse by drawing a legal analogy. She said to him, if a person dipped his finger in honey and put it in another's mouth on Yom Kippur, would it not be bad for him to be forced to eat on Yom Kippur? But in the end, would it not be sweet for him because it's honey? That's her argument. And he accepted it. He accepted her argument. While the opening exchange between the woman and the rabbi feels so devastatingly familiar, a woman claims an act of sexual violence occurred, and the response is, are you sure? The kind of direct interaction that follows on its heels is actually kind of shocking. First, that she has the confidence to respond at all. Second, that she figures out a way to respond and explain her experience in terms that she thinks a male rabbinic leader would understand. And third, that the rabbi listens, learns from her interpretation of her own experience, and realizes his initial understanding was wrong. Indeed, if you look at the broader passage of the Talmud where this anecdote appears, the woman's narration and the rabbi's change of mind offer justification for a general legal principle. If a sex act began as coerced, but became apparently volitional, trila ba'ones, sofa baratzon, it is still treated as coerced. That's the legal principle that this story justifies. It doesn't matter if her body may have had some sensation of pleasure, she's still considered to be the victim of an act of coercion. So this story that began as a kind of textbook paradigm of how leaders disappoint us has turned into something else. It's become a moment of real listening and learning. I'll share a personal anecdote. I remember very clearly the first time a student approached me saying the equivalent of, I was raped, right? Wanting to talk about a past experience. She was not looking for a legal ruling about whether she could remain married to her husband. She was single. But she was looking for religious counsel that was essentially along the lines of, am I guilty? Perhaps in some past world, her question would have been whether she should somehow bring a korban chatat, a sacrifice, right? Some way to acknowledge her guilt. Now, by all means, I certainly did not ask her whether she was sure she was raped, like the rabbi in this anecdote, but she was clearly asking herself this question. She remembered every detail of the context and the stages of interaction so clearly, and she was trying to understand whether she may have been complicit at any point. The event traumatized her, not because of the severity of force or violence, but because of the haunting feeling that perhaps she bore some of the guilt. It was as though she was asking herself, but did I enjoy it at any point? This is a maddening reality for many victims of sexual violence, we know. Their own internal questioning. It is hard to fully discern whether it is a natural way to feel or stems from deeply reinforced cultural assumptions, but it can happen. And profoundly, this is not the way the Talmud wanted people to approach a situation of rape, at least not until its later layers. In fact, our Yerushalmi passage explicitly raises this possibility only to reject it. Rabbi Yochanan asks, maybe you enjoyed it in the end, but the whole point of that interaction is actually to reject that line of thinking. If a sex act began as coercion, it legally remains coercion. Might there be complexity in how a person experiences that sexual coercion, including maybe some kind of bodily pleasure at some point as a coping mechanism? Perhaps, but this bodily sensation of pleasure should in no way be confused with the mental state of legal consent. The law means to reassure her that even if parts of her own experience might confusingly echo indicators of consensual participation, this has no bearing on the coercive context. For a rabbi acting in a pastoral capacity, it may be helpful for a victim of sexual coercion to share how they are trying to sort through the complexity of their emotions and possibly how their body felt. But for a rabbi acting as a legal decisor, there's only one thing that matters. What started as coercion is always considered coercion. The moment of listening and learning in this brief but profound anecdote has lasting impact. Those few little lines in that passage in the Yerushalmi have a lasting impact when we turn again to the parallel passage in the Babylonian Talmud. We see that Avuah d'Shmuel's extreme position that basically erased rape that we started with there is not the only view in that source. You can turn to source 10. The later Babylonian sage, Rava, has a different view. This is in the bold in source 10. Okay, so after we have Avuah d'Shmuel saying, a woman who is raped is forbidden, maybe what began as coercion ended as volitional, that suspicion about rape, is followed by, this differs from Rava. As Rava said, any case that began as coercion and ended as apparently volitional, even if she said, let him be, that if he had not attacked her, she would have hired him, she is still permitted to her husband, meaning it's still considered a case of coercion. For what reason? Passion has enveloped her. This isn't a mental legal state of consent. There's something else happening here when it started as coercion. And the Talmud there continues, it is taught in accord with Rava and brings a similar ruling to what the Yerushalmi passage had. There is a case that is permitted even though she was not coerced, which is that a case that began as coercion but ended as consensual, meaning this is the legal principle. What began as coercion is going to be treated as coercion throughout. Rava in the Talmud is a later sage, and he is known for bringing traditions from the land of Israel into the legal discourse in Babylonia. That is one thing he does often. And perhaps this is an example where he learned from the tradition of Rabbi Yochanan and his encounter with the woman who spoke about her experience of rape. And he brought this teaching and insight to his colleagues in Babylonia, and it became part of the legal discourse in the Babylonian Talmud. The main principle that, again, is framed as coming from this interaction between the rabbi and the woman, the principle is, if it started as coercion, it remains coercion, no matter if there was some sensation of pleasure or desire. This is the opposite of blame the victim, not only in the conclusion where the victim of the sexual coercion bears no guilt, but also in a process that takes the experiences and words of a victim of sexual assault seriously. The law is forever influenced by that brief interaction of listening and learning. So now let's reapproach this story through insights of contemporary feminist legal philosopher Martha Nussbaum, who has done a lot of work on emotion and the law, and recently wrote about sexual assault, accountability, and reconciliation in this book, Citadels of Pride. We are in source number 11, okay? In our part three, A Bumpy Path, Anger, Listening, Learning, and Blessing. Here's some of what Nussbaum writes. Let's now think about anger. It expresses a demand. This is wrong. It should not happen again. It alludes to the past, but it faces forward and proposes to fix the world going into the future. This future-facing anger, this is the type of anger that I have called transition anger. Transition anger. Many feminists believe that retributive anger is a powerful aid to the feminist struggle, even if they also believe that it distorts the personality to be in a state of retributive anger. I have argued, however, that there is no tragic tension here, since the retributive type of anger, the type aimed at inflicting retrospective pain, is no help in the feminist struggle. And instead, she describes agape, love, involves seeing in all people a core of dignity and worth, and further a potential for change and growth, however obscured and blighted by the history of that person's deeds. At this time, meaning our moment, of justified denunciation and unremitting vigilance, feminists, I believe, should also and above all be people of love. Just as women demand that their voices be heard, so we must also resolve to hear one another in all our differences, creating a dialogical culture that is also a culture of empathetic imagination. To listen and to hear in a climate of respect for human potentiality. And because that potentiality is sometimes impossible to see, after all, it's about a future potential, we should also be people of practical faith and of a trust that is to some extent as yet unjustified and unjustifiable. I see Nussbaum's call for a transition anger that has an eye towards learning, growth, and trust in community as a broad invitation. Through her words, I do not have to be stuck in a tragic tension around how to relate to Torah, including some of the most challenging parts of Torah that we have seen, how to relate to Torah writ large. I can feel a powerful form of transition anger in this moment as we work through confronting sexual violation and reimagining sexual ethics. I can feel a powerful form of transition anger, both towards Torah and towards our community, and then leap into a deliberate stance of mutual listening and growth. In that way, I would say, Martha Nussbaum invites us not only to see potential, even in people who may have committed past violations, right, who may have been bad actors, but also to turn to an entire tradition in the same way that she turns to the Western tradition and see its potential. When I study a passage, like we saw in the Babylonian Talmud, that seems to just erase rape with an extremely distressing suspicion about any act of rape, I am going to insist that there is more potential in Torah, that Torah has not yet lived up to its full potential. And that is going to motivate me not to objectify Torah as a kind of static object, but to insist that Torah continue growing into what it could be and to closely explore all the different parts of what Torah is, so that I might find that anecdote where one rabbi listens to one woman describe her experience, and that moment of listening and learning can have ongoing ripple effects, not only in how it influences that particular passage in the Talmud and other parallel passages, but in how we might try to draw and learn from that and reenact that moment of listening and learning. That is a transition anger that doesn't avoid moments that have gone wrong. It doesn't paper over moments that have gone wrong in our text and in our culture, but also insists and creatively insists on the potential that we have as people and the potential that our Torah has. This is how Martha Nussbaum relates to the whole kind of Western tradition, with full acknowledgement that women have been objectified by that Western tradition and canon. She reclaims the robust tools within Western philosophical thought about virtues, vices, emotions, and applies this complex discourse of subjectivity to include women as complex selves. How do we, all of us, even those marginalized by a great tradition, a sacred tradition, deploy anger thoughtfully and move towards reconciliation and mutual dignity? This can be my project too. Torah has such robust language to do the work of growing a complex self, to do the work of trying to embody Tzelem Elohim and relating to others as manifestations of the divine. And even as the vast majority of this material that cares about the self has sadly failed to relate to women fully as complex selves and has failed to interpret sexuality in a kind of ethics that really honors two complex selves, I can read myself into it and strive to act informed by this guidance to reach for, to believe in, to access the potential of the complex self as part of redeeming not only myself or those of us who have been marginalized by this text, but also as part of redeeming the Torah itself and bringing it more fully to its full potential. I want to close with one other story that is about the power of listening and learning. This is source 12. About the interaction between Hannah when she's praying for a son and Eli, the high priest at the time. And we'll look at this commentary primarily by Rabbi Elazar, a sage in the land of Israel, to see how he looks at that interaction and all of its bumps and missteps as a way to learn about the possibility for listening, learning, and growth. Eli said to her, "How long will you be drunk?" Rabbi Elazar said, "From here we learn that one who observes something inappropriate in his friend must rebuke him based on what they think they see." Jump down to the third paragraph here, the next Rabbi Elazar comment. "Neither wine nor alcohol have I drunk." Rabbi Elazar said, "From here, one who was mistakenly accused must make this known." Hannah says, "No, I am not drunk." And it was right for her to say that. And when the woman we saw in our story is accused of enjoying this moment of sexual coercion, and she says, "No, you don't understand." That is something that she needed to do. Eli responded and said, "Go in peace." Rabbi Elazar said, "From here, one who mistakenly accuses someone must make amends, and furthermore, must bless her. As it says, may the God of Israel grant your request." Right? So that's a moment where it was bumpy and the religious leader of the time totally did not understand this woman's experience. But then she spoke up and he listened and it ended in blessing. Now, this is a dangerous kind of interaction. It can create a lot of harm. If you look at the paragraph that we skipped now, Hannah responded and said, "No, my master," which in the text itself sounds very submissive. "Lo Adoni," she's respecting him as the religious authority, but explaining that he didn't quite understand. This midrash reads it differently. Ula or Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina said, she said to him, "No, master, you are not a master. Lo Adoni, lo Adon ata. You are not a master. God's presence and spirit is not with you. For you judged me as guilty and not favorably. Didn't you know that I am a distressed woman? Milo yadat di'ishak shad ruach anochi. How could you be so ignorant, so blind to my experience?" She says, it actually essentially disrobes him of his religious authority. So I think the takeaway I get from this interaction, where on the one hand, you have Rabbi Elazar, who essentially is arguing for the bumps in a feedback-rich culture where we mess up, we misinterpret, we're open to being corrected, things can move on in blessing, right? In some ways, I think that is where we are, and that is what we need to embrace around an approach to sexual ethics in our moment. We need to understand people get this wrong, people misinterpret. Let's get the voices out there that move us towards greater understanding. We will embrace the fact that this is a bumpy road and try to strive towards listening and learning. And yet we have to know that there's a lot at stake when this is misunderstood and people can actually really discredit their own capacity for leadership if they get this wrong. And yet we'll sort of realize the intensity of that dangerous outcome when we get this wrong, and yet understand that we get this wrong and still strive somehow for that possibility of listening, learning, blessing.